From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States long ago outlawed debtors' prisons through rulings by the Supreme Court and laws by Congress. Yet an ACLU report called A Pound of Flesh, The Criminalization of Private Debt, concludes that millions of Americans are threatened with jail over debts they cannot pay. And thousands are actually jailed. The debts can arise from mistakes or bank errors, can be incredibly low amounts. Through a web of aggressive and poorly regulated debt collection practices, and lower courts eager to incarcerate low-income people of color are disproportionately targeted. While the federal government is supposed to protect Americans from being imprisoned over the inability to pay off debts, investigative reporting reveals that President Trump's own son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, has engaged in aggressive debt collection from renters of his properties in Baltimore, Maryland. My guest is Rebecca Burns. She is an award-winning investigative reporter, contributing editor in These Times. Her work has appeared in outlets including The Baffler, The Chicago Reader, and Dissent. And her new article was just published in The Intercept called How Lenders Are Turning Low-Level Courts into Dickensian Debt Collection Mills. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is just such an infuriating story. It, reading it makes you so upset. Part of the story is how the courts function, and the other part is how the debt collection companies function. So give us a sense of what some of the egregious parts of this story are. Somebody who might owe something as little as a few dollars gets targeted by a debt collection agency. How do these debt collection agencies behave?
Right. As you said, debtors' prisons are outlawed. You know, this is sort of a relic of the past that we think about only appearing in Charles Dickens' novels. But collectors, and especially private collection companies, have kind of found a way to get around this. So what they'll do is, say someone owes back end to their landlord. Maybe even they've already been evicted, but they didn't pay a month's rent amounting to $600 or something, or a medical bill. Creditors file millions of sort of collection cases in small claims court every year. The person who's the debtor who's being sued may not even have been served properly, so they don't necessarily know that they're being sued, or they might. But a judgment occurs, and the court says, like, yes, you owe this much money. And then often people assume it ends there, but if you aren't able to pay, if you're unemployed, you have no wages to garnish, you're often actually called back to court for this thing called a debtor's examination, where you might be asked questions about your sources of income, your finances. And if you don't show up for that, collections companies can ask for the judge to issue a warrant against you. So sort of officially, the warrant is for contempt of court, is for civil contempt. But in practice, in a lot of these cases, there ends up being sort of little distinction for someone who can't pay a debt between being arrested because they can't pay the debt and being arrested for contempt of court.
So because they can't actually be incarcerated for not paying a debt, they can simply be accused of contempt of court or something else related to a required court appearance that arose from the inability to pay pay back a debt. The Kushner issue is really, really interesting. Jared Kushner owns a number of rental properties in Baltimore, Maryland. And last year, the Baltimore Sun did a fantastic report, investigative report, showing that that his company is engaged in a similar kind of aggressive debt collection scheme to squeeze money from their renters and essentially send them to prison when they can't pay off their rent. How important and how typical is this practice in the grand scheme of things? Is Kushner essentially engaging in, or is his company part of this whole situation in the country around debt collection?
Right. Well, the fantastic reporting by the Baltimore Sun showed that the company owned by Kushner, he's since stepped down as its CEO, but is sort of the most aggressive landlord in the state of Maryland pursuing this tactic. So since 2013, They had sought the arrest of more than 100 delinquent tenants. So in that sense, it's a really important focus. I think what this new ACLU report shows is that unfortunately, this sort of tactic of turning the courts into a collections agency is not uncommon at all. So the report documents cases of it being used not just by landlords, but for consumer debt like ambulance rides, medical bills, student loans, even things like gym and daycare fees.
Now, so someone may, you know, have written a bad check for, say, you know, a tiny amount, say $40. Why would a debt collection agency be interested in pursuing that? It is a tiny amount. I imagine that the amount of person power that it takes to pursue such a debt would just not be financially worth it for them, that they would consider walking away from it, but they don't. Why?
Right. Well, there's sort of a lot of facets of that question, but I think one thing that really struck me again in this ACLU report is that a lot of the companies showing up in court to seek arrest warrants for civil contempt are debt buyers. So they've purchased debt for pennies on the dollar and their whole business is going after it. So it's not just someone who initially, you know, made a loan or is a landlord. It's often the private company that they've then sold the right to collect the debt. And so that company's entire business model is based on that. And the report also sort of notes all of these very shocking examples of, you know, collection agency handbooks literally having a section, you know, explaining why it's easier to settle when a debtor is under arrest.
Wow. What about the courts, judges? The ACLU report shows the callousness that some judges have displayed when debtors simply say to them, listen, I'm on Social Security. I can't even pay $25 a month. Maybe I can afford $5 a month. And if they simply resist and say, listen, I just can't pay this much, the judge finds them in contempt of court. Therefore, they are arrested, which how, you know, that is different from a debtor's prison, I don't know. But the callousness among some of these judges is just astounding.
Right. Well, it seems like it's really an issue that there's a ton of variation between jurisdictions. You know, one of the bigger issues here is there's very little attention to these kind of low-level small claims courts, other types of courts that have kind of just become collectors' courts. You know, they're processing millions of collection lawsuits. Statistics suggest that collectors are winning about 95% of the time. You know, anecdotally, it seems that one of the reasons why they're winning so frequently is just the infrequency with which debtors are able to secure representation. So it could be that the collectors are collecting debt that they don't actually have evidence of or is too old, or it could be a legitimate debt that, as you say, someone is trying to explain that their only source of income is Social Security or unemployment or benefits that in most states are actually exempt. So it really kind of depends on the jurisdiction. It seems like both, you know, state statutes varying from state to state and also sort of how aware of the law judges are in this area.
Are judges in some cases just sort of stamping these arrest warrants as a matter of course without even investigating whether they're valid?
Well, so it's the judge issuing the warrant. So essentially the way it works is that the collector seeks it, but then it's the judge that has to issue it. But there were stories in the report of particular jurisdictions where, you know, they're issuing 20, 30 warrants a day and, yes, just kind of signing off on them. Even some cases, this is not something that I reported directly, but it's mentioned in the report, cases of sort of judges overstepping their bounds by like more directly threatening someone with jail time, which gets sort of even more into this territory of threatening someone with jail for inability to pay rather than contempt of court, which is, you know, again, the technical reason that someone would be arrested.
And of course, it's not a surprise that something like fewer than 2% of these collection cases have lawyers representing the debtors. The debtors are debtors because they are likely not able to afford to pay off the debt. How can they afford a lawyer? And of course, we know that that makes all the difference often in the legal system of whether you win a case or not.
Right, right. You know, what struck me, there have been previous sort of local reports of this issue, but it seems like one of the reasons we haven't heard a lot about it is just because, as I said, there is so little attention to kind of small claims courts. There have been very, you know, relatively few sort of consumer lawsuits arising from them. So we really just aren't hearing a lot of these stories until, you know, this is the first time that there's someone has kind of attempted to estimate nationally the scope of this problem.
Rebecca, the ACLU report showed a number of letters as evidence. This is where debtors first find out that the debts are being pursued. Tell us about the letters that will often end up, as the starting point for the nightmare that some of these cases can turn into. How threatening are they? What are the tactics that they use to freak people out?
Right. So something like one in three Americans will at some point have a private debt turned over to a collections company. They're often quite threatening. There are laws surrounding, you know, what they can and can't say with you. A collections agency cannot directly, often when a collections agency is threatening you with arrest, that's illegal if they haven't actually taken you to court. A collections agency can't have you arrested without this court process. But things like calling you constantly, there are many, many lawsuits sort of detailing debt collectors, you know, showing up at people's place of work, debt collectors calling people's of employers. I think it sort of works hand in hand. These, they're often called hard collection tactics that in some cases, or in a lot of cases are illegal, but might fly under the radar. That then kind of bleed into these tactics that are still technically legal, but are very coercive.
And often what the debtors end up paying, if they do, you know, find a way to pay back, is a lot more than they owed in the first place, right? Because they get all these fines and extra fees slapped on, which is, of course, what makes the debt collection part of it so lucrative for some of these aggressive companies.
Right. I mean, when you start to add on legal fees or, you know, in cases where you have payday loans, the sort of infamously high interest rates, that's how you sort of part of how you really see people getting trapped in a cycle of debt.
And in the, you know, in the beginning, their debt might have been just a tiny amount. In the end, it balloons into a much bigger amount. Tell us about it's important, for us to humanize the story. Tell us about the case that you've profiled of a man named Rex Iverson in Utah, and what happened to him, how his experience of basically having a health issue turned into a nightmare.
Right. So there are a lot of cases in the report of people whose sort of debt started with an emergency medical expense. So in this case, Rex Iverson was an out-of-work welder. He was taken to the hospital in an ambulance on Christmas Eve in 2013, wasn't able to pay that ambulance bill, so was initially sued over his ambulance ride. It was a city operating the ambulance company that won a judgment against him and the right to garnish his wages. But again, he was already out of work, so he didn't have any wages to garnish. He didn't return to court when he was summoned. We don't know why, because eventually what happened is that this warrant for his arrest was issued. He was arrested in January 2016 with a $350 bail set. He had apparently told jail officials that he didn't have any way to pay the bail, so they were in the process of booking him in. Later that same day, he was found dead in a holding cell, and it was later determined through an investigation that he had smuggled in strychnine pills and ingested them to commit suicide. This is a case, I think, especially part of what it highlights is the intersection of this issue with cash bail, and that's an issue that, you know, excellent reporting over a number of years has showed how that kind of traps poor people in jail, keeps them in the criminal justice system. And when you have, you know, someone going to jail because they can't pay their debt, and then often going deeper deeper into debt because they're in jail, you sort of really see how these different types of criminalization of poverty essentially are working hand in hand.
Criminalization of poverty. I'm so glad you put it that way. Rich people never have to worry about these issues, or very rarely. And of course, we are supposed to be protected by our government from these kinds of practices that can, you know, turn into such nightmares that some people choose suicide, or as Rex Iverson's case showed, just such a tragedy. So the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the CFPB, was supposed to be exactly that kind of agency. One of the few in government that was designed to protect ordinary Americans. And under Donald Trump, what has happened? You know, he promised to do away with all regulations, meaning protections of us. I'm assuming that agency has now pulled back from overseeing how debt collection agencies operate.
Right. Yes. So, I mean, one of the big high-profile things that the CFPB under Mick Mulvaney has already done is, delay promulgating new rules over payday loans, which, of course, we've heard a lot of stories about how, these are a really big source of people sort of entering into this cycle of debt. Interestingly, in a memo issued to staff, Mick Mulvaney had said that he wanted to be a data-driven agency, and the data indicated that debt collection was a problem for a lot of people, which it is. It's, I think, a third of the complaints that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau receives most years are related to debt collection. Certainly, we should be skeptical about what kind of rules regarding debt collection would come out of the current CFPB leadership, and whether they would really address these deep-rooted problems. This is a problem where people aren't getting the right disclosures to notify them of their rights when debt collectors are going after them. But obviously, we see a much deeper problem here when courts are, some people would say, sort of rigged in favor of the collectors.
Right. Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your Intercept piece as well as the ACLU report from our website later. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Burns is an award-winning investigative reporter and a contributing editor at In These Times, and her work has appeared in outlets like The Baffler, The Chicago Reader, Dissent, and The Intercept. Her new piece that we've just been discussing in The Intercept is entitled How Lenders Are Turning Low-Level Courts into Dickensian Debt Collection Mills. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.